Illinois Soul, you're listening to Dialogue, an exchange about culture straight from the soul. I'm Patricia Bradford. Across the country, the conversation around reparations is getting louder.
Reparations.
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 Reparations for descendants of slaves.
Evanston, Illinois made history, becoming the first city in the country to approve reparations for Black residents.
Reparations are efforts meant to address the long-term impacts of slavery and systematic racism. Cities across the country like Evanston, Illinois, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, are taking steps towards reparations. Some offer cash or housing help, others focus on education, health, and land access. Now, a local group wants to bring that effort home. The Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition is calling for reparations for Black residents right here. Just last week, the group hosted a reparations town hall to hear from the community and shape what local reparations could look like in this community. Before that event, Dr. Jeffrey Trask, the coalition's president, sat down with us at Illinois Public Media. And here's what he had to say. Dr. Jeffrey Trask, thank you so much for being here with us. I just want to start by asking, can you just tell us a little bit about what the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition is, and then what's the mission behind the organization?
We kind of have an acronym of EAR. It's Education, Acknowledgement, and Reparations. And education is vital because as someone who's been pretty deeply immersed in this, I'm learning something new all the time, every day seems like. So there's a lot of information to learn, a lot of things that are going on, a lot of history there to be able to understand. And also the acknowledgement. Acknowledgement is important because people often ask the question, what's the difference between good programming and reparations? Well, it's the acknowledgement. It's to be able to identify specific harms that were done to African-Americans, past and present, and to be able to say, okay, we acknowledge those harms and we're apologizing for those harms. And so we want to, you know, make sure we don't just pretend like they don't exist. And then the third piece is reparations, because without the reparations, then it's all talk. Mm-hmm. And reparations is not just about money. It's about, it's partly about education, you know, because you get the word out about what's going on. But it's about policies, about legislation. It's about practices and procedures. It's about all types of things that has led to some degree in the past or present to have African Americans suffer in some form or fashion. And I always often say that reparations is only as limited as to our creativity and what reparations could look like.
So the reparations town hall will include community leaders like Carol and Aaron Amons, Dr. Robert Spicer, Dr. Lakeisha David, among others. Why have the conversation now?
Great question. And it's funny you mentioned that because one of the calling cards of reparations movement is reparations now. We don't want to wait any longer. You know, Black people have literally waited for about 500 years altogether. People don't understand this, but the slave trade started way back with Christopher Columbus, you know, even before him a little bit, where there's the Pope at the time had a papal decree called the Dum Diversus, and they had other decrees along the way following that one. But what the Dum Diversus decree said is that it was for the King of Portugal. Says you can go and capture, enslave, do whatever you need to do to, quote unquote, save souls, right? And so to Christianize the world, you get a permission slip to do whatever you have to do. And so that literally translated into the transatlantic slave trade. And that was like the permission slip, if you will, that got it started in the first place. Given that language, given that thought process, people who were kidnapped were prisoners of war. And the reason why that's significant is that if you look at that as prisoners of war and a crime against humanity, there's no statute of limitations on that, right? You know, if you can talk about other types of things, there's a statute of limitations on being to get repair for it. But war crimes against humanity, that includes being prisoners of war, there's no statute of limitations there. So the whole transatlantic slave trade should be something that is acknowledged, that it has to be, you know, acknowledged and repaired based on what happened there. And to kind of identify that in more detail, when the United States was formed in 1776, as a brand new country, you figure, okay, they just brand new, just gave birth to a new nation, you know, zero on the economic list, right? But it only took until 1860, about 80 something years later, for the United States to become the second largest economy on the planet, only behind Britain. How did a country who was just started off, you know, 80 something years ago, surpass countries who've been around for 4,000 years, you know, China and Egypt, all these other countries around the world been around for thousands of years. How did they just zoom up the charts?
Right,
right. They zoomed up the charts because of things like the cotton trade. In 1860, 53% of the money that was coming into the United States came just from the cotton trade alone, right? And so, you know, you're talking about the financial portfolio of the United States being founded during these days where they were having free labor. And it's a pretty simple concept. I mean, if I own a grocery store and my competitor owned a grocery store down the street, and I'm not paying my employees, and they are paying their employees, right? And if you know business, 65% typically of your costs are employees, you know, for labor. So if I don't have to pay 65% of my costs, my labor costs, and they do, my prices are going to be rock bottom, and they have no chance to compete with me. That was what the United States was able to do with cotton. Able to produce, sell, and deliver cotton cheaper than anybody in the planet, to a point where over half of the money coming in to the United States was just from cotton alone. Not even counting tobacco and some of the other things that they were taking advantage of the slave trade, but just cotton alone. So you're talking about the United States becoming this zero to number two in that short time frame due to not having to pay, you know, for their labor. You know, and so when people talk about, well, that happened way back then, and why does it matter now? Well, it's because people are able to have been taken advantage of that now. You know, people come to the United States for opportunity from all over the world. Well, how did that opportunity exist in the first place? Mm-hmm. Right? It existed because of the history of Black people having to be forced and participate in this labor, unpaid, sun up to sundown for literally centuries. You know, and so when it comes to getting reparations, you know, I always say the most that can be done is at least that should be done, right? Because there's not enough that can't be done to compensate for all that. You know, all the kidnapping and the murder and the torture and the separation of families and the free labor, there's nothing that can make up for all that. But at the very least, we should start doing something now.
So then, looking at this from a local level, what exactly does a reparations program look like in Champaign, Urbana?
I can give you just one possible example. Champaign, Urbana, or at least Urbana, spent some money with a consulting firm to observe, say, for example, policing in the community. And that report came out, it's public information, and it showed that African Americans were twice as likely to be stopped than white people. And then among those who were stopped, African Americans was twice as likely to be searched than white people. And then you have the situation where now you have a disproportionate number of Black people having to go to traffic court. And because unless you believe that Black people don't use their signals or don't stop the stop signs more than other racial groups, which I'm sure is not the case, unless you believe that, there's a disproportionate disbursement of tickets that's going on here, right? So we know this based on, you know, a well-paid consultant firm to find this out for us. Well, why not have a relatively modest reparations fund, maybe at the courthouse, where African Americans can help pay their traffic fees and court fines, whatever it may be, so that we are acknowledging this disproportionate treatment, and now we're trying to repair it through having that fund available for African Americans for that. That's just one tiny example mm-hmm. of things that can be done. So a huge part of this is the healing process of people just acknowledging that, you know what, you weren't treated fairly, you know, and now we want to do something about it. Give you an example of history of Champaign-Urbana. Someone did a dissertation research in 1991, looking at the Black people who were kind of forced to live in the north end of Champaign through redlining, because redlining happened all over the country, including Champaign-Urbana. And there's even some racially based language in covenants, land covenants, even today that our county clerk is trying to get rid of. There's about 757 parcels of land in Rantoul, Savoy, and Champaign-Urbana that still have language saying that you cannot sell or lease this property to anybody but the Caucasian race. And so he's working at trying to find owners of these lands so that we can get the lease that language out of there after all this time. And that's, you know, this is talking about 2025 and that language is still in there. But in any case, Champaign-Urbana force folks to live in certain areas. And you can even see this on the map today. If you look at a topical map of where, you know, Black people live in Champaign-Urbana, it's very, you can tell they're very concentrated areas. One of these areas in North Champaign, they didn't have plumbing. They didn't have, you know, in some cases, they didn't have outhouses. And so this researcher that did their dissertation interviewed some people there. And I'll never forget one of the quotes, and that was published in one of the U of I newspapers or somewhere, where they said, you know, they asked the question, well, how did you use the bathroom, right? Even they didn't have any outhouses and have any plumbing. And the quote was, well, we just waited till it got dark. Because, I mean, there's no place to use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't want people to see you use the bathroom. So you literally had to wait till it got dark to go out and use the bathroom.
Wow.
And that was in 1951 where that person was given that quote. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about even ancient history here, right? And so we want to identify those types of things and be able to say, okay, what can we do to rectify it? Because what happens is that in these areas where people, black people are redlined, it tends to be divested in various ways. And again, that was the justification for Evanston's reparations.
So we're understanding why now as far as having the conversation, but then why is it important for universities and historians to be a part of this conversation as well?
Yeah, I think it's vital that at the very minimum, people are knowledgeable, right? I believe in education. I believe that in the area of reparations, that if you have the faintest presence of justice and fairness in your heart, and you just dip your toe in research, you're going to move along that spectrum of being, you know, where reparations is not again, it's not polarizing, it's not something that should be on the outskirts, but it should be common sense. It should be normative. And I believe education is the key to that. We are making sure that various folks within the university are aware of what we're doing, hopefully can support it in various ways, maybe have someone, maybe not officially on the commission from representing U of I, but somebody from U of I on the commission, you know, however we do it, we want them involved. We actually plan on talking to the faculty senate in the fall. And again, we already talked to some other officials there, you know, so far. So the idea is to try to get them in the loop in various ways and kind of, you know, as many parts of it as possible to be knowledgeable about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to maybe even help spread the word about it.
If you're just now joining us, this is Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Patricia Bradford, and we're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Trask, president of the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition. We discussed a little bit last week before the reparation town hall what reparations could look like here in Champaign-Urbana. So how far along are you then in the process of bringing reparations to Champaign-Urbana?
I've been talking to Champaign City Council folks. Still got to talk to a few more, but the idea is to, right after Urbana, I go through the process to start it with Champaign as well. And then we're going to, after City of Urbana, after City of Champaign, we're going to talk to the Champaign County Board and ask for them to officially vote on an ordinance to support the forming of a commission. We are asking each of those entities to contribute $25,000 to help fund the commission. And that money will go towards holding events like we're doing, our coalition's doing, gathering information from the community, surveying the community, maybe providing town halls like we're doing, whatever it takes to get information from the community so that they're informed about how to put their harm report together, and also pay researchers. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about being in Champaign-Urbana is like, if there's, you know, we have a long list of researchers that we could tap into, right? And so that funding will go towards, you know, paying researchers to do the homework.
Do you have a timeline set on when this could be put into fruition?
Hopefully, you know, as soon as the different councils and entities vote to approve the commission, we hope to have the commission form, you know, maybe by the end of the summer. And then it'll be their task to create a timeline as to planning the events, planning the public input, however way they need to do it, and then take however long to do that. I don't want to give too many timelines on how they're functioning because they're not even formed yet. So, but, you know, whenever they do get formed, they'll come up with a timeline and you know, what they do. Usually, like the State Commission for Illinois, I've only been on there since September, but they started, I think June would be like the third year that they've been operating. And they really got their motor running the last year or so. And so my hope is that within a year or two that the commission will be able to, you know, do work, do the research, do the community input, identify harms, come up with a harms report, attach that to recommendations for repair, present it to the various entities, and hopefully, you know, pass them and go from there.
I guess for those who then don't understand still the work that you're doing, what has kind of been the biggest misconception then or kind of backlash regarding the work that you're doing?
Yeah, there's a series of commonly known issues or questions people present when we talk about reparations. One, for example, is this happened in the past. I was involved with slavery. My family was involved with slavery. You know, why do people today deserve compensation for what happened so long ago? To make it a more personal example, if my great-grandfather was tortured and murdered and lynched before he had my grandfather, I wouldn't exist, right? You know, so, you know, history matters in all types of ways.
Right.
And we acknowledge that in so many other facets of life. But for some reason, when it comes to reparations, people have a hard time acknowledging that the past affects the present. And then even epigenetically speaking, you know, we know that trauma that people experience can mess with your DNA, and that DNA can transcend generations.
Mm-hmm.
They've done studies with mice, for example, that had mice averse to cherry blossoms. The kids and grandkids of those mice were automatically averse to cherry blossoms, right? For no other reason other than that it was in their ancestry. Prisoners of war in the Civil War, those soldiers who were kept in prison camps versus those soldiers who were not kept in prison camps, their descendants were more likely to commit suicide and had other traumatic issues going on. You know, and so there's this history that matters in genetically, biologically, historically, politically, economically. You go down a list, all that history matters, and it has an effect on today. So that's one of the arguments. Another argument is often, if you give African Americans all this money, they're just going to kind of put it right back into the system, or it's going to be wasted, or, you know, so, you know, why bother? And I say to that is, show me the research that says that's going to happen. You know, we only have limited options so far to show what actually happens. Like in Evanston, I mean, for the first couple of years, it was only able to go towards housing. So we know that people spent the $25,000 towards housing. Just in recent times, they actually got $25,000 cash. You know, so other than that, we have some examples where people were giving a base minimum income. Like in Houston, they did that for, and it wasn't just for Black people, for anybody who was low income, you got $1,000 a month for a year. In that particular example, most of that money went towards stabilizing people's housing. That's just something what they did with the money, right? And so one of the, you know, it really is irrelevant to a degree what happens with the money anyway, because my example that I give, that if I was a young man 30 years ago when I was 20 years old and I got put in prison for a crime I didn't commit because a racist police officer put me in prison. Again, not an uncommon story. We hear these things happen all the time when folks finally get exonerated out of prison and they come out of jail and they get a lawsuit, right? So say that happened to me. I lose 30 years of my life, so no family, no PhD, no health center, nothing. Everything that I've accomplished in 30 years doesn't exist.
Gone.
There's nothing that can compensate for that loss, right? Now, say I get my $2 million as a compensation for this injustice. Now, first of all, I want my $2 million, right? I don't want to walk up there with $0. It's only a token of what I'm due, but I do want it, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll make that clear. But it doesn't matter what I do with my $2 million either, right? I don't care how, it doesn't matter how I spend it. I get it because it's the just thing to do. It's not charity. It's not a gift. It's not a favor. It's the minimum what's due me, right?
Right.
You know, and so when it comes to how people spend the money and all that kind of stuff, yeah, I want African Americans to get reparations. I want African Americans to make sure we spend the money as wisely and efficiently and as best we possibly can. But at the end of the day, it's not the point. Which again, I have to pause to say, reparations is not just for Black people. It's primarily targeted and directed towards Black people, but everybody benefits from reparations. When we heal the part of our body that is most affected and is most hurt, we improve the entire body, right? And so when we do reparations, we want everybody involved in this. We want, you know, everyone has a place in it. Everyone has a role in it. A good part of my coalition are white allies, right? And we need white allies. We need other racial groups. People want to say that reparations is divisive because only targets Black people. Well, first of all, other people have gotten reparations over the years. Native Americans have gotten many examples of reparations. Japanese Americans have got reparations. Jewish individuals have got reparations. Even white people have gotten reparations. When Abraham Lincoln outlawed slavery in Washington, D.C., they paid reparations to the white slave owners, right? So reparations is not new, and lots of different people have gotten it.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Trask, thank you so much for coming into the Illinois Public Media studio today. We really appreciate you for sitting down with Illinois Soul.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. If you missed the reparations town hall, or you're looking for a little more information, the coalition meets every third Thursday of every month at 6:30 p.m. at New Covenant Fellowship in Champaign. Champaign Urbana Reparations Coalition is a financial supporter of Illinois Soul. IPM News covers the group as it does any other organization. That's all for this week's dialogue. Our team includes Kennedy Vincent, Ariel Raveny, and me, Patricia Bradford. The theme was composed by Lamont Holden. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are a part of Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll talk to you again next week.